Unfortunately, the change was short-lived. The following fall, a small group of members, after a drinking session, decided to take some pledges and show them what paddling felt like. After my attempts to have those involved punished, I came to a moment of truth. If the fraternity wanted to continue down the path of self-destruction at a time when attitudes were swiftly changing about the acceptability of such behavior, then it was their choice as undergraduates. But I was not going to be a part of it. I ended up resigning as fraternity president a few months early. At the same time, I remained active as one of four student leaders who worked with university administrators to develop ways to move beyond hazing. I eventually graduated, wondering how much progress we had really made trying to bring about positive change in the UT fraternity system. Nonetheless, I was convinced that it was the right thing to do. Nationally, SIGEP has taken a lead for many years to move beyond hazing, and I've heard reports that our Texas chapter has done the same in recent years as well. Unfortunately, despite continuing efforts to end hazing, this social evil continues at UT and elsewhere. The state of Texas has passed anti-hazing legislation, and UT has adopted strict rules forbidding hazing and requiring victims to report incidents to the dean's office. Over the years, several student organizations have been suspended for violating these rules. Yet hazing still goes on. In December 2005, a young pledge in the Lambda Phi Epsilon fraternity died as a result of a hazing incident. Consequently, the chapter was suspended until 2011, and three fraternity members received criminal indictments. It's terribly sad that tragedies like this continue to mar the fine record of an otherwise great institution like UT. This college experience left a lasting impression on me. Most significantly, it showed me how difficult it can be to change a negative culture that has grown up in an institution over time. No matter how obvious it may be that change is needed, and no matter how hard people of goodwill fight to create that change, social inertia and the selfish motivations of a few individuals who benefit from the existing regime make systemic reform very challenging. It's a lesson that those who want to fix Washington's broken political culture will need to take very seriously. Resigning as president of the fraternity in early fall 1989 opened the way for me to pursue another opportunity, one that turned out to be crucial for my career. I was about two semesters short of completing my coursework at UT, and I hadn't yet decided what I was going to do after graduation. Since I was taking a somewhat lighter course load at the time and had some additional free time without my fraternity obligation, I reached out to Bill Tryon, an alumnus who had belonged to Sigma Phi Epsilon my freshman and sophomore years and was now working on a Republican gubernatorial campaign. I told Bill I had some time available and would be interested in volunteering to see what a statewide political campaign was like. This was a natural outgrowth of my family history, and I liked the idea because I thought it might give me an opportunity to work in Austin. Why did I focus on an opportunity in the Republican Party? The choice didn't reflect a particularly strong ideological bent. Overall, I did feel more at home in the conservative-leaning Texas Republican Party, but my affiliation was more a matter of family history than rigid conservative belief. During the 1980s, I followed my mom and many other Texas Democrats in migrating to the Republicans. Texas had been a one-party state for more than 100 years, since the end of Reconstruction following the Civil War. Over the years, though, there had been a conservative wing and liberal wing in the Texas Democratic Party. Since 1980, Texas has voted Republican in presidential elections. Many Texas Democrats over the course of the 1980s believed the National Democratic Party had been moving too far left. My mother was one, as was I. She switched parties in 1985 during the period of the Reagan Revolution. She ran for Congress as a Republican the following year, losing to the incumbent, Jake Pickle. It was also the year I turned 18. In fact, the first vote I ever cast was for my mother in the Republican primary. In 1988, I cast my first presidential ballot for George H.W. Bush, whom I also got to meet for the first time during a campaign event for my mother. Little did I expect to get to know him personally more than 15 years later. Bill phoned me back that afternoon and asked if I'd be willing to work part-time on Clayton Williams' gubernatorial campaign as a press assistant. Williams was a charismatic businessman who had built himself a fortune through successful investments in natural gas, real estate, banking, and telecommunications. He even appeared in a series of popular television commercials for his own long-distance phone company, Claydesta, named after himself and his wife, Modesta, wearing a business suit and a cowboy hat. Williams promised to bring his authentic Texas style, his businessman's intelligence, and a tough anti-crime stance to the governor's mansion in Austin. But he was a novice politician, and his inexperience would prove fatal. After meeting with the press secretary, Bill Kenyon, I was hired on the spot and started work immediately. Among other duties, The job entailed getting to the office at 6 o'clock every morning before anyone else had arrived, going through the major newspapers, and clipping and copying noteworthy stories relating to the campaign and prominent state issues, so everyone, including the candidate, would have them to read right away. The 20 to 25 hours a week I committed to working quickly turned into 30 to 35. I'd signed on to the Williams for Governor campaign early, which is always a good move for a young, aspiring politico, and my dedication and hard work were noticed. Williams ended up winning the Republican primary overwhelmingly, defeating three notable rivals without a runoff, an impressive feat for a first-time candidate. The personal money he invested in the campaign helped, along with his down-home charm, and it looked as if he had great promise, capturing the electorate's perennial longing for something different from the typical politician. Shortly after the primary, Kenyon asked if I'd be interested in serving in a full-time press advance role, traveling ahead of Williams, the candidate, and making sure that public events, including news conferences, were properly staged with the right backdrops and visuals for the cameras and that Williams was fully briefed on the important aspects of the event. I jumped at the chance and put finishing school that summer on hold. It was exciting to move to the front lines of the campaign and have an opportunity to get to know the man who might be Texas's next governor. Williams came out of the primary in strong position and with growing momentum, leading his Democratic rival, the charismatic and beloved Ann Richards, by a seemingly insurmountable margin. Williams had a populist conservative appeal. He was perceived as an outsider and successful businessman who could take on the state's bureaucracy in Austin, streamline government, fight crime effectively, he would teach felons the joys of busting rock, and best represent the values shared by the majority in conservative-leaning Texas. Richards, though well-liked personally, was perceived by many as too progressive or liberal for the state, and her 1988 speech at the Democratic National Convention attacking Texan George Herbert Walker Bush only reinforced that image. Richards had served as a Travis County commissioner in Austin when my mother was mayor, so we'd cross paths at political events when I was a kid. When Williams ran against her for governor, she was serving as the state treasurer. I knew she had lots of personal charm and would be difficult to beat, even when Williams was leading by 20 points after the primary. I viewed her as too left of center and knew she was vulnerable on the issues, but also knew she was adept at positioning herself publicly as more mainstream. Right after the primary, however, Williams' lack of political experience began to hurt him as he made a series of impolitic remarks and downright gaffes. For example, Williams refused to shake Richards' hand after an event, annoyed by an anonymous smear campaign against him that she had failed to denounce. But Texas men pride themselves on their gentlemanliness, and for Williams to publicly snub his opponent, and a lady at that, was viewed as beyond the pale. Much worse, however, was an ill-conceived joke Williams uttered during an informal press session at his ranch. The weather that day was lousy, and Williams quipped to a group of reporters that bad weather is a little like rape. As long as it's inevitable, just relax and enjoy it. This wasn't just a case of political incorrectness. It was a horrendously insensitive remark, and the fact that Williams was running against a woman only made the circumstances worse. I was informed later that as soon as the words were out of his mouth, Williams's press secretary quickly spoke up and told the assembled writers, "This is all off the record." But at least one reporter pointed out, quite correctly, that no one had agreed to anything of the kind, and all the reporters were soon writing about the comment. It was inevitable that Williams' remark would make its way into the headlines of the papers and the TV coverage, and it did the following day. Perhaps engaging in some wishful thinking, the candidate told his staffers that they were exaggerating the likely impact of his gaffe. Of course, he was way off base. The next day, the press secretary ordered me to collect all the news clips reporting and commenting on Williams' comment and get in early that weekend morning to answer phones so that the candidate could see for himself the depth and breadth of the public outrage. The phones in our campaign offices were ringing off the hook, and I was the only one initially answering them, as instructed. Texans took Williams' remarks very personally. I remember one caller tearfully talking about her sister's tragic rape, a violent assault that left her permanently disfigured and emotionally scarred, and demanding to know how a candidate for governor could joke about such things. I had no answer or excuses to offer. All I could do was express my sincerest sympathy and let her know I would make sure to pass along the message. I did, to Williams himself over speakerphone when Kenyon, the press secretary, called in and told me to read out some of the calls. One of my favorite classes at UT was a leadership course taught by Sarah Weddington, a longtime friend of Ann Richards who was known for her involvement representing the anonymous Jane Roe in Roe v. Wade, the case that made abortion legal across the United States. The class was relatively small by UT standards, and quite a few bright, politically engaged students were taking it, and it was always interesting and informative. I was still a part-time staffer on the Williams campaign at the time. Our debates were intense, but always cordial, except for the day after Williams's remark, when my more liberal-leaning classmates let me have it pretty hard. I eventually managed to get a word in and settle them down by letting them know that I agreed it was offensive and reminding them that I was not the one who said it. Thanks to these and other missteps, Williams' substantial lead in the polls dwindled to virtually nothing by Election Day, yet he still almost pulled it off because of his populist appeal. Richards came out on top with a very slim plurality. It was a painful learning experience for those of us who'd worked long hours for a candidate we considered bright and promising. Vowing not to return to the up-and-down world of political campaigns, I briefly joined a small business started by some campaign colleagues before deciding that the next summer I would go back and finish my undergraduate degree. But my vow to avoid political campaigns turned out to be temporary. After completing my degree that next summer, I spent 6 years bouncing back and forth among campaigns, grassroots political outreach, and Texas government. In 1994, at Mom's request, I managed her first successful campaign to statewide elected office. Following her victory over the Democratic incumbent, I was asked by a new state senator, Tom Haywood, to serve as his chief of staff. I had managed his previous campaign in 1992, which he'd narrowly lost to an entrenched incumbent against heavy odds. I became a close friend of Tom's, as well as of his dedicated daughter Denise, who kept close watch over her father's interests, especially after he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Tom's illness didn't prevent him from serving in the Senate, and I worked with him for 8 months, including getting him through his first legislative session as we agreed. Mom came knocking again for her re-election campaign, which she easily won. Then it was off to a government affairs position in the Lower Colorado River Authority, LCRA, a quasi-state agency, before managing Mom's next race, this time for the powerful position of Texas Comptroller. In each campaign, also served as chief spokesman. In January 1999, I was expecting to return to my position with the LCRA when Governor Bush's communications director, Karen Hughes, came calling with an invitation that would change my life.